Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, David, Vicki, and Jay will have a wrap-up discussion of the 2022 crop season. We will discuss both the challenges and the opportunities that producers have faced during this 2022 growing season, and as always, we'll wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Well, hello, everybody.
Hey, Jay.
Hey, Jay.
How are y'all?
Hanging
in there.
Good and dry.
Good and dry. Is that the same thing, good and dry? I don't think it is.
No, it's not.
No.
But I'm plenty dry. How about that?
It is plenty dry. We have, I come back from Maine on September the 9th from a hunting trip up there, and when I was cleaning out my truck, I took my backpack and hung it in a tree there to air out a little bit, and Saturday a week ago, I pulled it down out of that tree and went to the farm and did some stuff, and it just dry as a bone.
I had
no precipitation at my house since the Saturday of Labor Day weekend, and here we are recording today. It's middle of October, so that's a good 6 weeks at that point without any rain, and we were on the dry side well before then. So,
absolutely. I think it's been dry all – seemed like it's been dry at my house all year long, and then, you know, we got a couple of inches of rain, I guess, and things kind of green back up, and everybody kind of got to looking forward to maybe a good fall, and then, boy, she just turned off dry again, and, you know, it's everything's brown as a biscuit at my house.
The thing about this second spell of dryness that you mentioned, we did the same way at my house. We had some rain middle of July or so. But the big difference is early on in the season, we had so much rain left over from the spring, is we still had good
moisture.
subsoil moisture down in the ground. Of course, roots had to develop and get down to it before they could find a drink. But you go out and try to dig a hole right now, and we're very, very dry as far as subsoil moisture goes, too. And it's going to take some real recharging of the water levels to get that back up. And
unless you're living in Eden, like Vicki has been living all year long, where they were getting some rain just about the whole time we weren't getting any rain. They were getting the rain about every other day. So
that is true. And I mean, I said something this week, last week a couple of times that, you know, we were fortunate over the summer. And if you've been listening to any of our podcasts through the summer, you know that David's been giving me a rough time all summer because.
Deservedly so.
Well, I guess so. I mean, from y'all's viewpoint, yes.
Absolutely.
You know, but we were very fortunate to pick up some rains, and it was like each time that it was about to get critical, and having conversations about, you know, what we need to do and making some management decisions, you know, because it was at that critical point, especially with corn pollination. It was like, you know, is it, you know, if we don't get a rain, and then we would get a rain. So each time that we were right there kind of at that, you know, critical point, we would pick up a rain. And so we were fortunate throughout the summer, but we are in the same boat as you all. We have not had any measurable rain now for several weeks.
You know, typically we think as far as root development goes, it's good to have a little bit of time in between those rains.
Sure.
That encourages root stimulation. It gets out and goes and looks for a drink, as I like to say, but this year, there just wasn't much down there to be found.
And there's no drink to be had right now.
It's still that way.
Yeah, and, you know, and we've had some, I guess the yields have probably varied as much as any year that I've been a county agent, really. You know, you're in the same field and you go from zero to 300 plus in the same pass, just depending on what type of ground you had and the lay of it and, you know, all those kind of things. So, you know, and I'm sure Vicki up in her area has had some really sustainable yields that have been pretty good.
Yeah, we have.
And in Jay's area and where I live, you know, it's been kind of the other way. You know, it's been pretty tough. But, you know, it's been a pretty tough year in, year out. It's been pretty tough this year.
It really has, because, you know, if you think back, you know, prior to, before we was ever ready to plant, you know, that was that overlying, what about input costs? I mean, these crazy high input costs. Mm-hmm. So back in January and February, you know, we was doing a lot of talking about being prepared and what we can do differently and hold our yield based upon the input costs that we were hearing And, you know, if you remember, even back early on, they weren't even pricing anhydrous.
That's right. Yep.
Because, you know, they didn't know what it was going to do. And so you had that even, that pressure and that uncertainty and stress coming in before. And then you add the supply chain issues of wondering, is there going to be enough? Are we going to have enough Roundup? You know, what, you know, those issues that you're dealing with. Then you get into planting season. It looks like it's going to be pretty good. Mm-hmm. And then it starts raining. And it rains. And it rains. And it rains. And it rains. So it's just been a stressful year from the beginning of 2022 from a standpoint of planting the crop and getting it in the ground. Yeah. And then here we are at harvest.
Well, you know, that we talk a lot about the different challenges that if producers have faced this year, and you mentioned most all of them there, from the supply chain issues to the moisture, whether it was early in the season when we had plenty of it to later in the season when there's none, and still real none to be seen in any type of outlook anytime soon. But, you know, I think there's some opportunities to be had there, and one of the opportunities I think that producers have had is they had a chance to evaluate the way they've always done things.
That's right.
And look at new and find new and innovative ways to make changes on the farm, whether it was dealing with supply chain issues or just the overall input cost. A lot of people made the decision to make some cuts at that time, and may be glad at the end of this season that they did.
Yeah, especially down in our area, Jay. They're probably glad they cut some things. But, you know, those things are not over. I mean, and that's the problem you're going to get into. I think the supply chain issues is something that's not over. My wife is a nurse in Paducah, and, you know, she was talking about they were having a shortage in contrast, which is, you know, for those folks that wonder what that is, that's a liquid of some sorts that they inject, you know, to be able to tell about your heart, whether, you know, everything's working like it's supposed to. And in simple, very simple layman's terms, that's what it is. She would have to explain the rest of it.
I've had that done.
Right. So, yeah. So there's a shortage of that going on right now. So, I mean, you know, those things are not over, and that's you know, it's just not limited to agriculture. It's everywhere, and then those are the issues. And fuel prices are fixing to go way back up again, you know, the way they talk. So, I mean, our issues are certainly not over by any stretch.
And also the supply chain issues, not only on the crop inputs that we're talking about, you know, but also repairs. When you're down and you're broke down and the repairs, I mean, there's still an extra wait time there sometimes on getting what you need. And
or the overnight charges are astronomical.
Oh, yes.
I mean, overnight physically means somebody has to go get it a lot of times. And, you know, time was, if you needed a part during harvest season, you called your dealer, and more than likely they had it or had close access to it. Mm-hmm. If they didn't, somebody in the next town over might. Yep. Now I've heard producers talk about, you know, having to find parts and source them three and four states away.
Yep.
It just depends on what your dealer has in inventory or what they have in their system, because a lot of these dealerships are tied together and work together.
That is absolutely the truth. And you know, those parts are that much more expensive. You know, and getting those parts is just, you know, I think that's one of the things that's you know, has gotten us, is how much all that stuff's costing now. And, you know, those input costs are one thing, but being able to keep the machinery running is completely something
else. I'm going to compound that one step further and finding the technicians who can put those parts
on.
That's right. Our ag service industry is not exempt from not being able to find help, just like all the other industries out there. They have people that they readily depend on, but as some of our workforce is aged and retired or gotten out and changed jobs, they have difficulty finding folks to replace them with.
Yeah, I think that's something, you know, we experienced a little bit of that at lunch today.
Yes, we
you
did.
Know, they didn't have enough help to kind of get things going. And, where are all these folks? You know, that's my question. Where are these folks at?
And how are they sustaining their lifestyles?
Absolutely.
So we may not want
to. Because I need to figure it out.
We may not want to know the answer to that.
Well, and I tell you what, farmers aren't exempt from that issue either, because you know, my brother farms, as I've said before, and, you know, he's been fortunate to have help and, you know, this year and years past. But, you know, with Dad not being able to help him the last, you know, last year even, you know, but they can't find – people that can run equipment, or, you know, or especially truck drivers. You know, it's across the board. I think, you know, most farmers will tell you that they need truck drivers, you know, and
it's industry wide.
It is. It's industry wide. I mean, I don't think anybody's exempt from that finding good help, but it adds a lot of stress.
There's a really good article, and I believe it's the October issue of Kentucky Farm Bureau's magazine about H-2A laborers. And in Western Kentucky, where we've raised a lot of tobacco through the years, we tend to think about H-2A laborers as being our Hispanic migrant force that comes up and helps put that tobacco crop out and get it in. Actually read an article where a grain producer was sourcing some folks. They were from South Africa. Yep. All of them farmers themselves, but because they're in the Southern Hemisphere, they're looking for things to do in the wintertime, which happens to be our growing season,
right.
And come over and operate equipment, and seemed like a really good opportunity to find good help and qualified help, not
with
just
experience.
Help, but qualified
with
help.
With experience, that's a big thing, absolutely.
Well, Jay, you went over and helped with that yield entry that we did on soybeans. That farm actually has two H-2A workers that's helping them. I don't remember. I think you may have seen run across the field, I believe.
Yeah,
but
did.
I think they started utilizing H-2A workers just a few years ago. But, I mean, you know, they're a big operation, and they needed help. And I mean, that was the avenue that was
And that's not a program
reliable.
That's not without its
challenges,
I guess, is probably the best way to say that. I mean, that's a program that you have to, a lot of paperwork has to be done with that. You got to find the people, you know, all of those things. And I mean, that's certainly a challenge.
And housing.
Housing and all those different things. So, I mean, it's a big deal for sure. Absolutely.
One good thing about that program from a producer standpoint is once you have those guys, you don't have to worry about them jumping the fence and going to a neighbor that's going to pay a couple of dollars more an hour.
Yeah.
They're contracted with you and for your duties. The one thing with tobacco production we've seen through the years is it may take a year or two to get those hands integrated into your operation and the type of skill set that you need. With a grain producer, it's totally different because you're talking about real technology that they're having to work and deal with. And I've always felt like if you can find that good help wherever they are, that's the avenue you need to go.
Yeah, my experience with those, you know, Hispanic folks that used to come up from Mexico there that helped us in the Baca, it was, you know, those folks are the one good thing about them, and Jay is talking about it, is you knew they were going to show up for work, number one. And number two, you know, they want to work.
They
want to make money, and you know, maybe a little bit different from our American workers in that sense is that they really want to work and to make money. So, I mean, that's two very good advantages maybe of having folks, you know, help you in your operation from that standpoint.
And it seems, too, you know, you would think, obviously, the language barrier would be, you know, the communication part of that would be difficult. But usually there's one that can communicate pretty well, and then that person communicates for the rest of them, or it seems to be that way.
That's the way it is, you know, where the place that I worked. And I used to get tickled at one of the guys' name was Guido, and my wife now was coming to ride with me in the combine, and I called her and said, hey, I'm sending Guido over there to get you, you know, just get in a truck with him, and he'll bring you right over here. Well, she got in a truck, and she's from Livingston County, and her dialect is a bit different than most places. But she was trying to talk to Guido. Guido didn't speak any English whatsoever.
And he didn't speak Livingston County.
No, he didn't speak Livingston County for sure. And I would get so tickled because she got in the combine and said, well, the only thing he'd say was, see, every time she'd say something, you know, he'd say yes. And, you know, that's back then was all he could say. But he can speak English now from being over here for 5 or 6 years. So
I've worked with a lot of them through the years who could understand English.
Right.
They just couldn't reciprocate.
Right.
They couldn't speak.
That's true.
And a producer told me one time, I had been by his house, you know, a couple of days before looking for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I tried to ask where you were, but nobody could understand me. And he laughed. He said, no, they all could understand you.
Yeah.
And I said, no, they couldn't understand English. And he said, watch this. And he told a joke.
And he said, watch how many of them laugh. And, of course, most of them laughed. They understood the joke. They understood what you're saying. They just can't speak back.
Right. Yeah, can't communicate back in English. Yeah.
And that's something, you know, through 20 years now of working with tobacco producers who bring those migrant laborers in, I have seen as much growth in the English language in the Hispanic labor force as I have that Hispanic language, depending on the dialect, because a lot of those Mexican dialects are different too.
Yes.
But I know a lot of producers that are very fluent in Spanish now because they've learned to communicate with them.
I used to get on one of our guys and I'd tell him every year he would go back to Mexico and I said, hey, you need to learn more English, you know, before you come back. And he'd look at me and he goes, you need to learn more Spanish.
That's
a two-way street, he's saying.
That's right, exactly.
So. But I have, you know, the highest regard for almost all those guys that I worked with that come up from Mexico and from other places. I've worked with some from Guatemala and different places. Christian County had a producer, had the same guy back several years in a row. He'd come for the summer to work in tobacco. He was a school teacher back in Mexico. Mm-hmm. I mean, held a full-time job. It was just an opportunity to come up and work and help provide and do a little better for his family. And if you can't respect that, it's on us.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you mentioned yields earlier. You know, I think, I don't know about you all, because I know, as you have mentioned many times, that you all didn't get the rains that we did in Webster County. But I will say, you know, most of our producers have been pleasantly surprised. You know, it was, I think, before we got into the fields this fall, there was still a lot of, you know, just wondering about, well, I wonder how this is going to turn out. Because you can go out in the field and you can try to do some yield estimates, but you all know as well as I do that it's pretty hard to really nail that. Until you put the combine in there, it's pretty hard to see where you are. And ours have been pleasantly surprised in corn and soybeans, you know, both. I'm hoping that yields were better in some of these other counties than what they might have been thinking it was going to be in June and July.
You know, I think it just depends on where you were, and we've talked about this on this show a lot. It just depends on where you were in Kentucky as far as, you know, what kind of yields. You know, I've talked to several folks kind of east of us that didn't get the rains kind of like we did and were pretty disappointed. And then I talked to folks that might be a little north of us that were pleasantly surprised. Mm-hmm. They were pretty apprehensive about, you know, getting in those fields and seeing what they had. But, you know, some folks, it's just like everything else, you know, some folks are happy and some folks are not. But I think, you know, for the most part, I think you'll see folks fairly disappointed in what their yields were down in our area. Folks were starting to get out double crop soybeans here, you know, out there in Christian County. I notice a lot of folks are starting to start in on those. And so I'm interested to see what some of those are turning out simply because after they planted them, we didn't have any rain. And we finally got some rain, and, you know, it was pretty late before those beans ever got above the wheat stubble. Mm-hmm. So I'm pretty interested to see what they actually ended up turning out. Just from a curiosity standpoint, I guess you could say. But, you know, hopefully they're turning out 40s or 50s, you know, because, you know, to be real honest, a bright spot right now would be pretty good.
Right.
Absolutely.
You know, from working down in that area a lot of years, we used to look at Labor Day weekend as being the cutoff time as when you absolutely had to have a rain concerning double crop soybeans. Very few places in the wheat production area, you know, double crop bean area, had that late rain this year. So they got what little bit they got, and it'll be surprising to see.
And speaking
see what
of,
they do.
Of, you know, wheat, I mean, we're looking at time to be planting wheat right now. I mean, you know, as a rule of thumb, you know, you wait till after October the 12th.
Yep.
But after that, you know, you're usually starting to see some wheat going in the ground, and right now there's just not moisture there to support it.
Vicky's referring to that October 12th. That's that Hessian fly free date, and to get past that, that's always considered the safe time for wheat producers. Mm-hmm. A lot of them hedge that and get started quick as they can, especially if they have a lot of acres to plant. But in a year like this, with very little moisture, I think we're going to see a real struggle for that wheat crop to get up and out of the ground.
I think if we ever do get some rain, I think it'll be a late planted wheat crop.
I agree.
But I looked at it last night. I mean, the next 10 days, we're not you know, they're not calling for any rain. So I'm not sure exactly what's going to happen. If folks are waiting for a rain or if they're, you know, what kind of stand are we going to have? You know, when, I mean, how deep are we going to have to plant it to get some moisture? You know, and that's the other question. I mean, I drilled some fescue and orchard grass about, oh, it's been almost a month now. It's not up. It's not coming up until we get some rain. So, you know, I don't know how long, you know, how long is it going to lay there before, you know, the question you start to ask, how long is it going to lay there before it'll just perish.
Yeah. And then the whole input cost again.
Yeah.
How much, right back at it. how much money do you want to put into this crop right now? Or do you want to put money into it and making that call when there's no rain in sight?
Well, and the bright spot in the grain industry at this point has been prices of the commodities themselves. They've held
That's
up.
Right.
If you start looking at the futures market right now, though, from December through spring, they're talking about a little bit of softening in that market. And that really makes you ask some of those hard questions about inputs.
Yeah, and the question comes up, is that part of that in our grain movement in this part of Kentucky has a lot to do with going down the Mississippi and, you know, and Hank Jr. said Mississippi's drying up. You know, is that due in part to that? You know, the grain price is softening up a little bit because of that, or what is?
Are they going to shut the Mississippi down?
I think it's certainly part of it. Folks that have, you know, been used to some of those cheaper avenues of receiving their grain are looking at trucking it, and trucking it means a whole different line of cost, and most certainly it's going to cost more to get grain to the places where it's needed. With the river doing what it's doing, I got to thinking about last week when we got together, the three of us had a little meeting, and I made a comment about two tugboats pushing a set of barges up the road. Y'all remember that?
I do.
The more and more I got to thinking about that, it's probably to get through some of these softer areas where they're having to be. Saw a little thing on the Ag Report this weekend talking about barges and that transport system. Talked about how tugs were having to double up to get through some areas to push more horsepower to push lighter loads. And I thought, you know, we just did notice that last week.
Yeah, so absolutely. And, you know, and I would hate to, you know, as it, you know, you always hear that trickle-down effect, you know, feed prices, corn and beans and those type things. But, I mean, I'd hate to have to pay much more for feed than what we're having to pay for feed right now. I mean, that affects the livestock industry as much as anybody. But, I mean, it's $120 to $150 higher than it was last year. I'm not sure calf prices have gone up enough to offset that, but
And that's not just that cost is not just on our commodity feeds, but all of our supplements that go along with it. I've seen cottonseed hulls, rice hulls,
soybean hulls, and corn gluten, and all of those things. You know, everything is just, you know, astronomical right now. And
thinking of the drought and the lack of rain, having to feed hay a lot earlier. And, I mean, are we going to run out of hay? I mean, is producers going to have to buy hay? And then what's the price of that hay going to be if you've got to buy it?
I felt like this late in the season that we would see the results of our yields, and that might even strengthen or stimulate the grain prices to be a little stronger than what they are. But I believe this softening is coming in two things. One, from being exorbitant diesel prices for hauling it, and two, the barge traffic up and down the river. Both of those things are helping to tail back those costs a little bit. If not, I think we'd see our grain market surging, so.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, going back to Vicky's, you know, there's not any stockpiling of fescue going on, so there's a lot of hay feeding going on. And to be real honest with you, if you've got your cows out on pasture and it's brown as a biscuit like it is at my house, you're not really helping yourself any. You just as well to be feeding hay.
Absolutely.
You know, because you're probably hurting that grass as much as you are anything, especially with it in the shape that it's in.
Doing your cows a favor either.
No, not really.
Out there,
you know,
to eat.
Yeah, and if you're spring calving cows, this is the fall is kind of your time where their nutritional needs are not the highest. But in reverse, if you've got fall calving cows, this is when their nutritional needs are at their highest. So you've got to feed your better quality hay, you know, at this point than you would be if you didn't. So, you know, those are some management considerations you need to be thinking about.
Just a little bit of a hint towards the show we're going to be recording next week with Dr. Jeff Lemkeeler. We're going to be talking about nutritional needs of the fall calving herd while we're in Lexington. So,
yeah.
And Kenny Burdine, too, about marketing, managing these, you know, with these high input costs and how that affects the cattle market.
So. Yeah, we're looking forward to that. David and I have to go east for a training, and Vicky's going to follow us along a few days later. But we're going to get a chance to sit down with a lot of our University of Kentucky Extension specialists who are located there in Lexington. That's something we don't get to do very often with those folks. And I think we've got, what, 7 or 8 folks we're recording with over a couple, 3 days?
I think it's 8 podcasts in about 3 days' time.
I'm going to be about talked out.
Yeah.
Best I can tell, but it's a marathon.
I think we'll get talked out pretty quick.
That's right.
You know, we think about fall, too. You know, fall is usually one of the times that we recommend. It's a great time to do your soil sampling, you know, in the fall. And because you've got the time to do it. I mean, you've got the time to get it sampled, and you've got a little bit more time to make the – you know, to make those applications that need to be made. If you need to be adding lime, fall's the best time to do that. You get across the field a lot better, and it's just a better time to do that. But in a year like this, when it's as dry as what it is, you know, that affects that too. I mean, you know, you're not going to be able to soil sample very well, one, because you're not going to be able to get the probe in the ground.
Yep.
It's not going to be...
It's not going to be as accurate.
It's not going to be as accurate, you know. Yep. And so thinking about holding off on that soil test until we get a little bit of rain, I think would be the better option for folks just because to have a better soil test result, it's going to be more accurate to what the field is, assuming that you take that soil sample in a manner that's going to represent the field in the best way that it can. And the drought is affecting that, too.
You know, it is. And typically this time of the year, when we think about fall fertilization, we think about our P and K and inputs from that standpoint. We had a show that just published this morning with Dr. John Grove, and David and I got a chance to sit down and talk with him about some of the work they're doing with fall nitrogen applications. And it was very interesting. It basically amounts to a pound and a half per 1,000 square foot, so you're talking anywhere from 45 to 55 pounds per acre of nitrogen just for root stimulation, just to do a little bit for maintaining that root through the winter. I found it very interesting as we were talking about that because a retired professor from UK, Dr. A.J. Powell, basically pioneered some of that work with turf varieties of fescue years ago and putting a pound to a pound and a half of N per 1,000 square foot, and it doing the same thing. It was basically for root maintenance. And if you hadn't had a chance to listen to that show, go back and find the one with Dr. John Grove. It's really, really good information. So
I had a guy call me this morning actually about putting fertilizer on his yard, and he said, well, what's the best time to put it on there? And I said, well, about the middle of November to the 1st of December would make a great time to put it on. But I said, I probably wouldn't put anything on until we got some rain.
Right.
Sure.
So hopefully, I said this the last time, I think, Jay. Hopefully the next time we all kind of get together, we'll have some rain, and for sure, hopefully we'll have some by the 1st of December. But that is, and I was going to bring that out for those folks working on pastures or hay ground. You may want to think about doing that. That is some work that is ongoing at Princeton, Kentucky, at the research center there. I think was some very interesting comments from Dr. Grove about the work that Dr. Teutsch and himself are doing there, you know, putting that fertilizer on that late. And it's a very closed window. It's not till the end of the year, or it's not till the first of November. It's like the middle of November to the very first week there of December. So it's
about a 3-week span.
Yeah, it's a very short window of when you need to put that on. So folks may want to think about that. I mean, and follow that work. And because if there's something to that, normally this is before all of the crazy fertilizer prices.
Right.
Normally that fertilizer is a little bit cheaper that time of year.
Right.
Because that's not their normal heavy use time of year. Now, you can just throw all that out the window right now because things are so crazy. But You know, normally that is a good time to be buying fertilizer.
Just to reiterate what you said, though, as dry as it is right now, we're going to need some moisture before we can do anything like that with any of our inputs.
Right, and as what Vicki said, you know, you got to have some moisture to even take a doggone soil test, you know. So, you know, kind of wait for some rain, but if we actually get some by before then, and you can get those soil tests run and try to put some on during that little – it's a close window. I mean, it's – like Jay said, it's about a 3-week period there that you can put it on to do you some good. Then after that, it's not going to do you any good.
And keep in mind, for anybody that's interested in doing this, this is not so much from a production standpoint that you're going to get a shot of grass in December. Right. That's not the point. Right. It's strictly for root development, root growth, and root health, if you will, so that it gets a quicker start off in the spring. And
then you just come back in the spring and throw you some more nitrogen on there and get your growth that you're talking about. But, you know, from a pasture standpoint and from a hay field standpoint, I think it'd be a great addition to your management practices.
Well, that root system is key to having a good plant of anything that you're growing. And I mean, that's kind of just giving you some bigger dividends at the end, you know. So
it makes it last longer too. And especially if you've got those cows pulled off or from a hayfield or a pasture situation. I know a lot of folks graze their hayfields in the wintertime. But you need a little bit of top growth there to store those carbohydrates and store those nutrients. But, you know, we need some root development there, especially if it's a newly seeded or something of this nature, you know, to be able to make the longevity of those plants, to make them last that much longer, we need to do a better job managing those.
And folks tend to overgraze anyway, you know, a lot of times. And so,
absolutely.
You know.
Especially you think about right now.
Exactly.
Folks are just grazing the fire out of their pastures and things.
It's not growing.
And it's not helping. I mean, it's not doing you any favors.
The old adage I heard years ago was when you think it's time to pull your cattle off a pasture, you're probably a week late.
Oh,
that's
right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, you need to be feeding that hay, supplementing those cows with hay anyway, but pick out a pasture that maybe the fertility's bad in. Right now is a perfect time to unroll hay. It's dry, and you can spread those nutrients over the whole entire field. I mean, there's two good times to unroll hay, when it's really dry and when it's froze.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the best times to unroll hay. Otherwise, it's usually too wet. Mm-hmm. So right now is a perfect time to pick out that pasture that's a little bit – the soil fertility is not very good. Go in there and start unrolling hay. And, I mean, you're spreading your fertility and building your fertility like you're supposed to be doing.
We've talked a little bit in this past. We did a show last year with Dr. Greg Halich on bale grazing. And now would be a time, too, to be thinking about that from those same standpoints, that you're spreading those nutrients around. You're not putting any extra of a stress or a load on one particular part of a pasture. You're moving that around and getting the cows an opportunity to kindly be themselves. You know, that old boss cow can stand there as long as she wants when there's another roll of hay out. And other ones can go find it.
And you lose less. I mean, you're utilizing more of that bale.
Yes.
That way, too.
Absolutely.
Less loss.
Absolutely.
Well, we've covered a lot of stuff here, and we've got a few things to still yet to go, but we want to probably go ahead and think about this week's timely tip. We try to have one of these every week. If you're used to listening, you know that's how we start the conversation towards wrapping things up at the end of the show. And this week's timely tip, as dry as it is and some of the problems we've had across the western part of this state, this week's timely tip is to work towards preventing fires during the harvest season by keeping your equipment clean and parked in areas where the danger of a fire is low. You know, right here across in the last week, I can think of fires that we've had in 5 different counties. Mm-hmm. And there's been for a wide variety of reasons. But, you know, one of the number one ways to help keeping a piece of equipment safe and keep from starting that fire is just by keeping the litter. If we're talking about a combine, keeping some of that crop residue cleaned off of the header, cleaned off from around where it's not going to build up in and around bearings that are spinning, and any places where they have the chance to get hot, I think is a good point for producers to be thinking about right now.
You know, I think a lot of folks will take a blower and try to blow those machines off every night or before they get started in the morning. You know, normally this time of year we've got a little bit of dew, that kind of dampens things a little bit, but we're not having any of that right now.
Right.
So, you know, keeping those machines, you know, to the, all the trash off of, like Jay said, especially around the bearings, when you have spinning bearings that are, you know, exposed on that machine, then, you know, those are good places for trash to collect because it's actually sticking out of the machine and got a little cover on it or whatever. But, you know, those are the places that the heat builds up. And you'll have spontaneous combustion there for sure.
Really, as dry as it is, it's a good thing to do, but really a good thing to do any time of the harvest season, just from the standpoint of keeping your equipment maintained. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to be greasing, you know, things regularly and maintaining that daily checklist of your equipment, and keeping that cropper as due cleaned off is going to go a long way towards preventing a breakdown too.
And just from a safety standpoint, make sure you got your fire extinguisher in the cab.
Make sure it's charged up.
And make sure it's a good one. If it's time to, you know, get a new one, then get a new one, because, I mean.
Or a sprayer with water. You might even nowadays, you might even have to have both.
Yeah. But as Jay said, there's been a lot of fires and, you know, ag related in some way. And, you know, that's just a scary time of year. And when it's this dry, to think about that. Two, in all of our counties, we have a burn ban in place. I think we've all been notified about that, and that's put in place for a reason. And I know that it's the time of year when everybody wants to start having bonfires, especially our younger folks, you know.
And getting a little cool.
Yeah, I've got two young daughters, and that's the thing they look forward to in the fall is having these bonfires and kids hanging out. But, you know.
A little bit of hen and shen going on. Yeah. I never good.
I never did nothing like that when I was young.
Something like that. Yeah.
Just keep in mind that burn ban is there for your own safety, and just, you know, just pay attention to that and respect that because you sure don't want to cause a fire that's going to lose your house or somebody else's or vehicles.
It's absolutely the smart thing to do. And even if our counties don't have a burn ban, we've seen these red flag warnings that have been put on by the National Weather Service. That's when our relative humidity is below 15%. Any type of moisture with the ground or leaves or crop residue is below 8%. And our winds are above 15 miles per hour. When you have those conditions existing, you have that red flag warning.
We've had those for several days.
That's right.
I can remember, I know 2 days last week for sure.
Right.
I'm not sure about the weekend, but I know today's one, if I'm not mistaken.
It is. I did a spot with one of the news channels out of Evansville last week on that same topic. So I think it's a good thing. You know, we think about all the ways we can prevent fires, but in that bad instance that you do have to have emergency personnel calling a volunteer fire department in or something, some of the other things we can do when we think about the entrances to fields. When we pull into these fields during this time of the year, what's always parked right there around that gap, and that's your trucks, any way wagons, any type of extra equipment that might be needed there on site, keep that stuff back away from that pulling area. If you were to have fire department come in, that gives them a little bit more room to work in. And keep those pieces of equipment shut down while they're sitting still.
Or four-wheelers and side-by-sides when you're driving across fields and things like that.
I particularly think about wheat harvest in the spring, and down in the southern part of our area where David and I both live, and we raise a lot of wheat. Therefore, we've got a lot of the double crop soybeans. Every year there's fire somewhere in wheat where somebody's driving a pickup truck across the field, and those catalytic converters get awful hot when they're touching that wheat stubble, and probably accounts for a lot more of our fires in wheat than maybe even a combine does.
And even that, some of that equipment, don't park it all up next to one another.
Right.
You know, give it a little space where if it does catch fire, at least you're not going to burn. Like, you know what, we used to park all three combines that we had there. We parked them all beside each other. Well, how stupid is that?
Right.
You know, if one was to catch on fire in the middle of the night, they'd all catch on fire more than likely.
Same way the semis head to tail, you know, in the field.
Yeah. So just give a little space in between to try to mitigate part of the problems that I think we cause a lot of it ourselves. And, you know, and do that equipment check. And like Jay was talking about, you know, you blow all that stuff off. That's a good time to check those bearings to see if there's a problem, because sometimes you can see a problem maybe even before you get to it.
Grease slung out of a bearing and things like that.
Right.
You can tell where there's going to be an issue if you look.
Absolutely. And, you know, and if there's somebody that's out around that piece of machinery, you know, be sure to keep your eyes open and watch for some of those things, because you can either hear it. If you can't feel it, if you're sitting in the cab and sitting in the seat sometimes, a lot of the older combines, you could feel something bad fixing to happen.
Right.
I'm not too sure you can feel it right now. If that thing had shake, you know, something terrible, but I don't think you can probably feel it as much now. But you know, keep your ears open. And for those folks that are, you know, kind of around you, if they'll kind of help you, and hopefully that'll mitigate a lot of those problems we've been having.
Absolutely. Well, we've covered a lot of ground today. We've talked a lot about a lot of the opportunities and a lot of the challenges that producers have faced during this 2022 year. So anything y'all want to add?
It's not over.
It's not over.
It's still, we still got a few months to go, so hopefully things will get better.
Especially in our wheat areas, we still got wheat sowing to do, and that's something that that folks, we're going to need some rain to turn that around and make it be what it needs to be.
And I'll throw out this too, if we do get some rain and we can get a probe in the ground, this is a good time to do test for soybean cyst nematode as well.
Absolutely.
In the fall.
Absolutely.
So just
forgot all about that,
yeah,
Vicky,
just throw that out there, that it's a great time to do that. So
and if you need to do that, you can get in touch with your county extension office. Those folks will be glad to help you with that. And if I'm not mistaken, there may be a program that maybe pay for some of those if you're in Kentucky. You know, there may be a program there that's available to you to help pay for some of those fields to be tested. So and I'm sure they'd be glad to let you know and help you
Get you the forms, because the forms go to a different place. But just contact your local extension office and get those. Now, you can sample those all the way up until the spring. If we don't get a rain, you can do that in the spring too.
Right.
But fall is a great time to do that.
Yeah, and with some of the diseases that we've had pressures with this summer, probably be a good idea to think about doing that for sure.
Sounds good. Well, like I say, we've covered a lot of ground, and we've got more to cover still whenever we get back together next week in Lexington. We'll sit down with a whole group of folks and make several shows for y'all to listen to in the future. And when you're listening to those shows, one of the things you can do now that you hadn't had the opportunity to do earlier is to listen to these shows on Apple Podcasts. We've got everything worked out and got our show up on Apple now. And
finally.
And finally. I know, I finally got that done. Anybody that prefers listening to your podcast, a podcatcher as I call it, these other places that take these things and help distribute them for us, we are available on Apple now for anybody that wants to listen to it. So we want to thank our host this week for our information. I think we had a good discussion about this 2022 crop season, and we want to thank our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. Until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.